There's a John Mayer song that goes back some 15 years ago, Waiting for the World to Change. It was a popular platinum song. It was a call out to the millennials that you can't sit back and wait for the world to change. You got to be the change, right? And where I sit and from what I see, I think many product managers at an individual level and many product leaders at a group level are still waiting for the world to change. Mm. And the opportunity to go out and seize the customer conversation, even if you have to break some glass to do it, is well worth it. And it's time to do it.
That's my guest on this episode, Mike Smart of Egress Solutions, an old friend of many years and a great product management thinker with a lot of experience in the trenches and as a PM trainer and consultant, as you'll hear. This is Nils Davis, and you're listening to episode 160 of the Secrets of Product Management podcast. In this episode, Mike Smart. I've known Mike for about 15 years. We've been product management friends, conversational sparring partners, and have even worked together a few times in that period. Mike started his product management career by transitioning from a sales and marketing role, as he shares in the interview. His background includes multiple leadership and executive roles in high-tech companies ranging from operations to product management to sales, and he spent a number of years as a trainer for Pragmatic Marketing, spreading the gospel, so to speak, of product management. Since 2009, he has led Egress Solutions. After recognizing that organizations desperately needed help implementing product management and product marketing best practices, and they still do, their engagements enable customers to establish product management and product marketing excellence across the product lifecycle. Recently, Mike has added a podcast into his portfolio as well, GTM Disrupted, focused on go-to-market, which is an area that both Mike and I are very interested in. And in this interview, I started by asking Mike to go back in history and recall when we first met all those years ago. Mike, welcome to the podcast, finally. We've known each other for 15 years. Do you remember how we met?
Yes, I do. But Nils, first of all, thank you for inviting me to join. I'm looking forward to this. I'm excited about the conversation. Either 2008 or 2009, Silicon Valley Product Camp. And I don't remember which year it was, but it was one of those early years when it just started. And I believe you were at Accept 360 as a director of product at the time.
That's right. Yep. And a product for product managers.
There we go. And I was at Pragmatic Institute as a consultant slash instructor. That's the context where we met. I think we ran into each other in the lobby and just started one of these explosive impromptu conversations. The chemistry ignited, which is what it's been like since then. The conversation and the energy hasn't changed, which is a great thing.
That's right. We have a great time talking about all things product management and other things as well.
I was going to say not just product management. There are other things as well. Yeah.
But we have a lot of fun talking about product management and where it's going, where it's been, what's wrong with it, what's good about it. Obviously, we are both big supporters of the concept. So you mentioned that you were at Pragmatic Institute, and maybe just quickly outline your career and where you started, where you went to, and where you are now, because I think it's pretty interesting.
So I have a long career in this. This gray hair is earned. And I, like most people, I didn't start out as a product manager. On the podcast that I have, I interview people, and nobody have I talked to in the last 18 months started out in product management. I don't think it exists. I came from a sales background, and I was hired by this company called TCSI, which was a four-letter acronym. We know that we don't use those anymore. We don't do that. But at the time, it was cool. Then it stood for Technicron Communication Systems Incorporated. And I won't give you the background on that because that's a total different interview and podcast thread all to its own. Just the phenomenal history of being in technology. But it was a middleware company, and it was building network management systems, what we called NMS systems, for the telecom industry. And I was hired in as a director of business development and realized in the process of building new market segments and going after business that product management was significantly broken. And I stepped over the line, and it became a challenge because I had great rapport with the CEO and the VP of marketing, and they poo-pooed the idea. They didn't want me to do it. And the CEO said to me, "You'll last 6 months." And then it became kind of, "How dare you tell me I can't do this?" And then I pulled out all the stops, and I found out that I loved it. I loved being able to dig deep enough into the technology and talk to the engineering team. And we had a lot of smart people in that company. This was a spin out of UC Berkeley's computer science department. So we had a lot of PhDs and a lot of really smart computer scientists around us. And because it was middleware, it was a bunch of routines and pseudocode that we had assembled into a product. So it needed a lot of product management care and feeding.
And was it, there was a product management or organization or department at the time?
There was a small group of people there who were very smart, and many of them had come out of engineering and understood the technology and the tech stack deeper than I ever would, but were not skilled turning the product features into things that people wanted to buy. And that's where the chemistry happened. And I came in from this sales marketing background, had spent time in a hardware space, had spent time in selling consulting services in the tech space. And I brought that, it's great to talk about how deep your stack goes and the feeds and speeds of it and the QA tests that you do, but people ultimately don't care about that. They're trying to solve a business problem. And here's how we have to talk about the business problem from their standpoint. And we started having traction and success. We launched a product that was basically a repackaging of some existing, and I'm going to call it code. That's all it really was, code, and renamed. And we launched a large telecom trade show with great success. And it was an example that I used for a lot of years going forward on how to take existing capabilities and existing technology, putting the right messaging, the right solution around it, and then obviously orient it toward user consumption and getting a new product out of it. And we had success with that.
Yeah. So once you articulated the problem so that customers, prospects would know that you solved that problem for them, it became a lot easier to sell it, I would guess.
Absolutely. And that was the missing ingredient. There was no way that I was going to come into this organization. There's a lot of smart people, much smarter than me, and lean into what limited technology understanding I had about that capability and that solution. So what I brought to them was this view, this insight that came direct from the customer. And because I was out talking to customers, I was out interviewing customers, I was hearing what they liked about the existing capability or what they didn't like. I heard it all. In the interest of trying to sell the existing capability, I did some 30, 40 ad interviews. And my VP said, you should document these because it's going to be important to be able to show. And that was probably the smartest advice I got. So I documented all of these sales calls. And I went in not trying to sell for the first time in a long time. I went in really to listen. That was a big part of the product management function at this company that wasn't being done. And so it was that input, that feedback, that understanding that I brought back in the building. And the engineering team was truly excited to hear about it because historically they had gone out and responded to sales needs that were, hey, I have this large customer called AT&T and they want to spend $7 million and all we got to do is build them X, Y, and Z. And they would go to work on it and they would close the deal at $7 million. And 2 years later, AT&T would have a solution that might have cost $5.5 million or even six. We're not doing the math on that. And what I represented was an opportunity to take this thing down because there aren't a whole lot of companies out there that have $7 million, even then, had $7 million to spend on a software product, a highly customized software product. It's to scale this thing down and offer solutions under $1 million at the time. I would say probably even getting down to $250,000 that could be sold repeatedly, right? That was the opportunity. That was the gap that people wanted to close and I was part of helping close.
Let's fast forward. Then you took that product management background or experience, you became a trainer for Pragmatic, and now you have Egress Solutions. You're a product management consultant, I guess is what we can call it.
That is an absolute 4X fast forward because there are a few stops in between.
We can come back, but I was just wondering.
Yes, but clearly, yes. I ended up learning how to do some interesting things around product management prior to going to Pragmatic Marketing. In fact, that was the course, the bet that I told you, the challenge that I was given. I went to Pragmatic Marketing because I realized I don't know how to do this job or Pragmatic Institute. I don't know how to do this job. I better learn. And at the time, that was the premier platform course that was offered to try and explain the role.
And that, but so now you're a consultant yourself.
Yes.
And you're going out and helping. So I'm wondering, do you happen to occasionally ever see the situation where product management is not doing customer discovery, like in your old company many years ago?
It's funny you say that because I had a conversation in a podcast with somebody week before last, and we were joking. His name is Ben Foster, and he runs a consulting company called Productify, and he has a book out in which he outlines the 10 dysfunctions of product management. And we were laughing and joking about this, to your point of the question, because we identified that these things exist today in the same magnitude that they existed 10 or 15 years ago. And one of the big dysfunctions is relying on a small group of customers to build out products. Yes, it's still pervasive today. Absolutely.
Obviously, I was a little bit joking
when
I asked
a
question.
It was a setup question, Neil. Yes.
Yes. We all know that's the number one thing that we're failing at as product managers at this point.
It begs the question, though, is why is that? After all of this time, are we still struggling? I'll use the term struggling with the notion of being inside out versus outside in. I haven't figured out what the stumbling block is.
But what do you think might be contributing to that?
We don't have enough time to talk about all my hypotheses about that.
Is it coming from within? Is it a product management problem or is it an organization problem? I have some personal opinions about that. I'd be curious.
I think it's too complex to say it's either or. I think it's a combination of both. I think that on one level, the organization is still much like we talked about some of the dysfunctions of product management. There are dysfunctions happening at the organization level as well, right? And one of the dysfunctions that's still going on at the organizational level is that the sales organization and those around it have a disproportionate level of influence over what the product looks like. They are still influencing. So that idea that I said, a boot group of sales guys going out to AT&T and scoping a $7 million deal and coming back and says, okay, guys, all we got to do is build this. I can't mention names, but I was involved in an engagement, a client engagement, where that same exact activity was going on 90 days ago, that the product organization was going to be asked to take the roadmap and invert it and turn it upside down to close a deal that was worth some significant amount of money.
Sure. So sales is still driving a lot. What do you think about the aspect of trust of the product org?
That's where one of the complexities come in. And I'm going to say this, and it's with all respect to all product managers, but there's a John Mayer song that goes back some 15 years ago, Waiting for the World to Change. It was a popular platinum song, We're Waiting for the World to Change. It was a call out to the millennials that you can't sit back and wait for the world to change. You got to be the change, right? And where I sit and from what I see, I think many product managers at an individual level and many product leaders at a group level are still waiting for the world to change. And the opportunity to go out and seize the customer conversation, even if you have to break some glass to do it, is well worth it. And it's time to do it.
Okay. Well, that seems like great advice to take away. We can't wait for the organization to enable us. We have to go make it happen.
The CEOs that I talked to, so I gave them permission to do this, but they still won't do it. And that's a loaded sort of dynamic, right? The conversation is, well, I told them they could go do that. But in the course of the conversation is, but you didn't tell the sales organization or the customer success organization to cooperate with them.
Right. Yeah.
Or you didn't set up a scenario or a platform in which this could happen easily. And I think in many instances, that's as good as it's going to get, that you're going to get people in leadership to say, okay, go do it. But they're not going to engage in rolling out a roadmap, if you will, if you figure out how to do it yourself. I think that's the nature of human beings. There's great phrases from generations ago about civil activists that people don't give you freedom. You have to take it. Right. If you go back to Mahatma Gandhi, the British didn't give India freedom. They took it. And I can go through a long list of things. But I think it's the same energy and the same dynamic that says, if you really want to excel at this job, you have to talk to customers direct. You can't not do that. You can't be a great product manager and you'll never elevate yourself to be a product leader if you don't understand intimately the customers that you're talking to and you don't get comfortable talking to customers.
Right. And your product is probably not going to be good if
that,
you don't
that
do that.
That goes without saying is that the downstream fallout of that is that you're going to build product that's going to, in the best scenario, it's going to be a near miss.
Yeah.
Or as my golf instructor used to say, that's a good miss. You'll get a good miss.
I always, and you've heard me talk about this, I have this metaphor for sports. It's honorable to compete on an even playing field and lose with somebody else, with another company, for example. It's dishonorable to not show up.
I agree.
Or to not have done the training in the case of a sports team. It's dishonorable to have lost because, oh, I didn't train. I didn't do the blocking and tackling. So you mentioned your experience long time ago, whenever that was. I won't say how many years. But and many of the same challenges exist for product teams. I'm curious, has anything gotten better in your view?
And you know this, and we've talked about this. I mentioned your previous company, Accept 360. Mm-hmm. We have had an explosion, which is also a sort of a point of pause and frustration. We've had an explosion in the quality, the quantity, and the insight that can be gained from data, analytics, and tools about what's happening with our product, and even much better at tracking those outputs. What you and I were struggling with 10 years ago is now it shouldn't be a struggle. Let me put it like that. There's a plethora of tools out there to help aid the actual task and work function and the workflow of product management, to assemble those inputs from the marketplace, from customers, from competitors, to organize them in a way that makes sense, and to display them and communicate them broadly to the rest of the organization. Mm-hmm. Those things were a job in and of itself. Much of that has been automated and simplified.
Well, that's excellent. I feel, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, that even though product is often not doing the things that we know we need to do, at least now we know we should be doing them, as opposed to there was a lot. I feel like when I started in product management, there was a lot of, I wouldn't even say ignorance. It was like, it wasn't, they didn't know things that they should have. It was like, nobody knew that they didn't know.
Yes.
Years ago. And now we at least know, but we're not necessarily doing.
I'll get back to your point about it's one thing to lose a game on a level playing field. I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it was a well said statement about level playing field, showing up, doing the work and losing versus not showing up. When I think about it that way, I say then, if we know what we should be doing and we're not doing it, are we better off or worse off? In other words, when we think about the repercussions of this gap that we're talking about, the repercussions potentially are harsher now. And it's not just, we don't do this in a vacuum, right? If I'm in a product team and in a product organization, I'm the leader of a product organization, and I know I should be doing these things today, and I know my team should be doing it, and I'm not doing them. And the repercussions from my peers, my executive level, leadership level peers, may be harsher because they also know that I should be doing it, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that we've seen lots of product orgs shrink lately?
Yes.
Let's call it shrink.
Yes, absolutely. There's a direct correlation. And I've had enough conversations with CEOs and COOs, investors over the last 2 to 3 years, that some of them come back and say, hey, Mike, we tried the training. We did that. We spent whatever. Some of them spent a lot. Some of them organized programs to help bring product people up to speed. And we're still not getting what we need from them to steer this product strategy forward. And so therefore, the only action that we can take now is to shrink the organization and reduce its costs. And it's a direct reflection of value contributed versus the expense of the organization. It's just a direct correlation.
So what do you think about Brian Chesky's at Airbnb? He said, we fired all the product managers and now they're all product marketing managers. He didn't really fire them, but he changed their jobs. What do you think about that? I'll let you answer that because I have an idea what it means, but I'd love to hear your...
I don't know enough about Airbnb to comment on it in any depth, except like you to read the headline and think a couple of things. Airbnb needed some headlines that were saying that they were changing the way they did business and they were moving in the right direction. So some of that falls into that area of putting out sort of the specific messages that investors want to hear. We're no longer wasting money. And it may be an immediate short-term overreaction to the problem that we've just talked about and described. But I do think there is a tell there. There is a signal to noise ratio that is increasing in its amplitude that says, and this is a premise and a hypothesis that I'm still working through, that says it is less about innovation going forward, innovation with a capital I. Mm-hmm. So the replication of the Apple phenomenon of the 90s is over, that you cannot copy that playbook anymore because it has played out. Go back to a sports analogy. There are certain types of sports where, I'll give the easiest one, when the 49ers were both Bay Area people, and mm-hmm. I know this podcast goes far away, but when the 49ers were a brand and won 5 Super Bowls, they had developed something called the West Coast offense, and it was a competitive advantage. And fast forward 20 years later, every team in the NFL runs a version of the West Coast offense. It is no longer a competitive advantage just to have that style of offense. So you have to figure out how to compete on something else. And so the point that I'm making is, if you think about this in a macro sense, especially in the little bubble that we live in inside Silicon Valley, every engineering staff and every product management staff rotates in and out from one tech company to the next over a 5-year cycle. So as they leave one organization, you pick the name of the company, brand name or not, and they go to the next one down the street, they take everything with them. You can't stop that. You can't prevent it. Mm-hmm. And so what they're doing is perfecting and commoditizing innovation with a capital I. So now everybody is doing some brand of innovation with a capital I. Where's the next competitive differentiation point? It's not on building faster technology. It's not on building and releasing faster. It has to be something else. And what Airbnb's example is, I think, is a recognition that says it's about engaging buyers. It's about engaging users. And that's where the emphasis and that's where the hard part of the equation exists now.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds a lot like product management.
It depends on how you slice it. If you want to be traditional about it, I would say yes. But then we have this other problem, is that the fact of the matter is, and you talk to a lot of product managers, and so do I, most of them are inside out. Most of them are not engaging with the marketplace.
Yep.
Most of them do not have fundamental knowledge for the reasons that we just outlined, right? And so we've seen then the split of the role into product marketing, which now has a charter that says you are aligned to sales, you are attached to marketing, it is your job to create the messaging and figure out who the competitors are, and it is your job to own the go-to-market strategy for the organization. And that role distinction, take it as you will, good or bad, I sit in the middle on it. I'm not biased for it or biased against it. That role mm-hmm. distinction means if I'm the CEO or C-suite member of the organization, I now have clarity about where accountability exists, mm-hmm. right? And I can now make decisions at that level that say, I'm going to fund the go-to-market exercise. That means I'm going to beef up the resources and the tooling on the go-to-market side versus funding the product creation and the product development side, because that looks like that's well invested and we're getting what we can get out of it.
That makes a lot of sense. I know you and I both think of go-to-market as a component of product management, or we've talked about it in that context. And you've been doing a lot of focusing on go-to-market recently. You have your podcast is about go-to-market, all that kind of stuff. Talk to me a little bit about go-to-market and why your focus is there so strongly and some of the key things that people often miss about it, in particular product managers.
It's exactly the sentence and the summation of the conversation we just segued out of, is that I had somebody come to me, this was maybe 3 years ago, and he is a sales consultant turned entrepreneur, built a platform. And he asked me to do a little research for him. And because he's a longtime friend, I did it. And the hypothesis he said was, can you give me examples that show me, because I'm talking to a group of investors, what is the clear, discernible life cycle of competitive advantage in our current environment? This is 3 years, actually it was 4 years, it was pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so I did a little research, pulled some of my own notes. I laid out a hypothesis to him. I said, if you take two companies in the same exact sector, tech companies, B2B software companies, the same exact sector of the industry, and they both glean a specific capability or feature, and one starts earlier than the other, then the life cycle of competitive advantage is probably 4 sprints. Now you figure out what a sprint is worth, whether it's 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 2 weeks, that's a competitive advantage. Now, there's a lot that goes with that. My little exercise, I walked away, and there were other people that I went and researched and I read some books on this. And it's, no, we're at a point where, and it's back to the point about engineering teams and product teams moving around the valley up and down Interstate 280 and Interstate 680 or any of the interstates that we have around here in and out of the MOFO area of San Francisco, we know that information leaves the building and goes with them, and people hire in clusters. And so the advantage is now, from an engineering technical standpoint, probably the length of three sprints. Maybe it's a year when you add in QA time and all these other things, right? So it's not sustainable. And we now have years of evidence and information from people like Gartner that say that because of this great thing, the internet may catch on one day, because buyers are now much more sophisticated about how they acquire even B2B products for the enterprise, that they've done 70 or 80% of the research before they ever engage with sales. So there has to be some other lever that we're using to get a buyer to engage with this, because it's not sales. When I was doing sales, I showed up with information buyers did not have. I showed up with resources buyers did not have. And so the value exchange between me as a salesperson in that time, and it wasn't that long ago, 20 mm-hmm. years, that showed up and said, this guy's bringing all the goods that we can use to help us make the decision. Now it's all on the internet. And there are businesses that have spun out that help even do the ratings for me. And so I don't need to have a sales engagement in the same way that I used to. So the value of selling has decreased. So how do we get buyers to engage? It has to be something else. So I shifted just recognizing this focus and this big gap. And the gap is still the problem that as organizations, most leadership teams still view go-to-market as a single-threaded sales motion. And they're struggling with that. And they're struggling to basically keep up with the business demands for them. Sales cycles are longer. Decisions get stalled. So it says that there's a massive issue there. And I've spent a year interviewing people like yourself and the industry experts. And nobody has an answer yet, which says we're early in the cycle. It says, how do we create the next breakthrough for our business, our industry, that allows us to then re-engage with buyers on a cycle that allows them to comfortably consume what we have to offer, make reasonable decisions about what are the puts and takes or the pros and cons of the solution we offer versus someone else, rather than get frustrated and stall out in a decision, say, we can't make a decision.
Right.
And that's where a lot of people are, right? So buyers are. It's like confused and consumed with the overlapping messages and the copycat messages that we all deliver to the space. That, you know what? It's probably not worth it to make a change.
So what I'm hearing is technical differentiators are short-lived now.
Or non-existent.
Or non-existent, right, often. And so the leverage point is really going to be more how we talk to the market about what we do. But what I think you also implied this, most companies, the way they talk to the market, you could just switch the name of the company in the material and it would still be true. There's no differentiation. It's very hard for the way that we're currently talking to the market for most companies, for a customer to say, oh, I see why I should buy this one instead of that one. And that seems to be the challenge in go-to-market at this point, right?
It is extremely the challenge to go-to-market, but it's not just a go-to-market problem. It is a product design problem.
Sure.
It is a roadmap problem. It is a what problem are you solving problem. And all you have to do to test this hypothesis is to become a buyer. Go out in the market. And anybody can do this, right? Go, if you're part of a small organization, join the team that's looking for a new accounting system, because you can offer some, volunteer, hey, I'll help you guys because I know how to break down the pros and cons and I know how to read through RFPs because I've written a lot of them as a product manager. I'll help you make this buying decision. And go listen to what people who are pitching accounting systems say to your internal company buyers about their different solutions. And you'll, if you're like me, you'll get to the point where you get impatient, maybe you get nauseated, because this is exactly how we do with our solution. This is wrong. It's totally wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I understand. It's, you're hearing the same thing. You're not hearing anything about yourself as a customer typically, or about your problem. You're not hearing anything about what makes us special. That's not what everybody else is saying, what makes them special.
And part of that is that the work at the beginning, and this is one of your pet phrases, because I've heard you say it a lot over the years, what problem are we solving, is missing from a lot of the product development work and capability development work that we do. we don't start there and we don't spend enough time. We may start there, but to me, the insight comes from rotating around that until it almost gets nauseating, because you really have to understand what problem we're solving. It's not, oh, they need a reporting system. That's a symptom of a problem. That's not the problem. Exactly. And so one of the things that's unfortunately not practiced well, and I'm not blaming anybody, this is just circumstance, right? It's that the identification of problem, the rotating around problem, I almost want to say something so almost obsessive, compulsive, sort of ruminating around problem is what's missing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So you have a podcast about go-to-market. Tell me the name of your podcast. Remind me of the name.
It's GTM Disrupted with Mike Smart.
Okay, there we go. So you can find Mike's really insightful interviews with a lot of folks, including myself. I don't know how insightful mine was, but
it was very insightful. I actually got a lot of comments on that.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it.
Early one. So yes, absolutely. Feel free to check it out. I love it.
So yeah, so great. It's a great thing. He talks to lots of people who know a lot of really interesting things. So worth listening to. Mike, I know you're short on time at this point. Do you have maybe three things you might want people to take away from this conversation? Things they can start doing? Ways they should start thinking about?
I started with one, and I still hear the noise about lack of respect and lack of control among product managers. And my advice is start doing it. Just start doing it. Don't be afraid to break glass. That's probably the biggest thing, is have the courage to step outside your comfort zone and even bend some rules. If you have an organization that you can't talk to customers without whatever, the next time you're at a trade show or the next time you have a meetup somewhere, talk to them anyway.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Make the distinction that you're not trying to sell them anything. That's one. The other one is more at leaders. It's this idea of business acumen. If I'm a product director and I run a small team, if I'm the VP of product and I have a larger team, or if I'm the CPO of an organization, there is no longer any excuse for that person at that level to not have a deep understanding of what's driving the business. One of my interviews in the podcast, GTM Disrupted, gave a great phrase, just that if I'm a CPO today, I'm more concerned about sales velocity than release velocity. I think that is so valid, that the days of worrying about just pushing something out of the door, that's a low value sort of role and job, because some of that almost happens by itself now. But understanding the cog in the wheel, that sales velocity, why aren't sales engaging? Why aren't customers buying? Why aren't we moving a needle on conversion rate? Those are things that are now starting to come back into the product organization. And I'm not going to suggest that you have all the answers, but I think as a leader in the organization, you have to be about the business of figuring out what those things are and not ignoring.
I love that. And I think that as product people, we do actually have some things that can help with sales velocity.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
We're not communicating and they're not asking us to communicate with us. So there's a big opportunity there for sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic. Mike, this has been great. I know you got to run. How should people follow up with you or contact you if you'd like them to? What's a good way to connect with you?
I actually love the contact. It means that somebody's out there listening, and that's why we do this. That's why we do the podcast. It's to serve our little egos about somebody listening to me. And I'm no different from anybody else. So you can find me on LinkedIn, and it is Michael Smart on LinkedIn. And the name of my consulting company is Egress Solutions, and that is egresssolutions.net. And again, the podcast is GTM Disrupted. So there's three ways to get a hold of me.
Fantastic.
And I readily receive any contact. Just reference this podcast. It helps me a lot to understand the context.
Great. Yeah, that's a great suggestion. I will put all of those connection points into the show notes. So anybody who goes to secretsofpm.com can find this episode and get all that information. This has been great, Mike. I've really been fun. I feel like we did not really get to everything that we wanted to talk about. So we're going to have to do it again.
We'll figure that out.
Yeah. Hopefully
and
in less than 15 years.
For a reunion, right?
Exactly. Right. This is fantastic. Thank you again for coming on the show. It was great to have you, and I look forward to the next time.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks again to Mike Smart for joining me on this episode of the Secrets of Product Management podcast. A lot of great insights from Mike, as well as a view back in history, and then some really great action points you can start doing today. As I mentioned, I'll put links to Mike's information, his website, Egress Solutions, his LinkedIn, his podcast, and all that stuff into the show notes at secretsofpm.com/160. If you like this episode and want to share the ideas in it, please feel free to tell your friends about it. It's a great way for the show to grow. And please let me know your thoughts on this episode. If you want to reach out to me about this episode or any other topic that I cover on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you. You can always find me easily on LinkedIn or my email, nils@nilsdavis.com. I'd love to hear from you. And until next time, this is Nils Davis. Bye-bye.